I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, calls are coming for San Antonio Congressman Tony Gonzalez to resign from office after a published report from the San Antonio Express News alleges that Gonzalez had an extramarital affair with a staffer who later committed suicide. Reporters from the Express News join us with the latest. And later on The Source, DEI has become a public enemy under the Trump administration. President Trump signed an executive order banning diversity, equity, and inclusion, saying that the policy discriminates. But there is ample evidence that DEI has made America richer, stronger, and more just. What's the future of DEI? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Donating real estate to TPR is a great way to support the station you love. We accept homes, land, and commercial properties. Visit tpr.careasy.org/real-estate-donation.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In a few minutes, we'll be hearing about the history of DEI and how it has made America great. But first, the San Antonio Express News broke the story that finds evidence that San Antonio Congressman Tony Gonzalez had an affair with a staffer who later took her own life. We're joined by two Express News reporters who wrote that story. It's now sending shockwaves across the 23rd Congressional District, where early voting is now underway in the Republican primary election for that congressional seat. We're joined by Bayless Wagner and Nancy Prayer Johnson. And welcome to The Source, both of y'all. Thank you for coming on the air.
Thanks for having
Thanks
us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Bayless, Gonzalez staffer Regina Santos Aviles died last September after setting yourself on fire. What do you know, what can you tell us about the relationship that you found out between Santos Aviles and how do we know that, and Gonzalez?
Yeah, so what we reported on was a text message that she sent to a fellow coworker in the Uvalde office, which was just two people, right? It was very, very small, and they were very close, where she said, she said, quote, "I had an affair with our boss." And so what I know from this former staffer is that Representative Gonzalez, this is what he said, Representative Gonzalez came and stayed with this staffer, Regina Santos Aviles, in a cabin that the former staffer that I talked to, that their family owned, two separate times for 1 to 2 hours each alone. And then she later told this former staffer that they slept together. After that Regina Santos Aviles' husband found out, it seemed to kind of end at that point, and she became very distraught.
Nancy, tell us more about the events that led, that we know about, to, Regina ending her life.
Yeah, I mean, we've been following this story from the beginning when it happened. It's quite shocking, right? Someone dousing themselves in gasoline, pouring it, that she poured it on herself outside her home, and that that law enforcement officials found her outside. She was engulfed in flames. She died the next day in San Antonio. It's been tough, right? Like, to get the records about the actual incident. We got just very preliminary information from the fire department in the very beginning. And the Texas Attorney General has issued a ruling that was in December, just withholding all the records connected to this. We know that obviously she was troubled. We have heard that even before this happened, that she was, had suicidal tendencies. That is something that we've been told by many, many sources, and that this wasn't the first time that happened. We know that, her husband and his attorney, now he's had two attorneys, has said that I think a key moment was when he said, "The truth will come to light." And so when he told me that, right, when this had happened, you know, that's not saying that there's nothing more, right? That's saying there's something here, and he just wasn't ready to speak about it yet. And so far, he hasn't been. One of the things that he talks about and his attorney talks about is, you know, they have an 8-year-old little boy. You know, he's about to be 9 years old now, and he doesn't want his son to find all the details about the affair, and that his father is the one that provided those details.
So, Bayless, what do we know? What is Tony Gonzalez saying about all of this? He's been denying this.
Representative Gonzalez has not really specifically addressed it. He said in an interview with Huntsville News back in the fall that all the rumors about the quote circumstances surrounding her death that was in the question posed by Huntsville News are false. When I went up to him and asked him which rumors, he said all of them. So he sort of indirectly denied it, but he's repeatedly refused to actually address the substance of what is being, you know, coming out as evidence now, which is that he had an affair with his staffer. He again this morning, without, you know, ever having responded to the Express News's request for comment and a detailed list of questions that we gave him, he told the Texas Tribune that he refuses to engage in these quote unquote personal smears, and that he blamed his opponent, Brandon Herrera, who actually nearly ousted him in 2024. So it's going to be a tough GOP primary race this year. He blamed him for, quote, using a disgruntled former staffer to smear Regina's memory and score political points.
Nancy Pryor Johnson, what are the rules in Congress against members of Congress having affairs with their staffers?
Well, you know, I think it definitely crosses some ethical boundaries as far as, you know, the authority that he has over her as well. I think it's very problematic. But again, until, I think every reporter in Texas, you know, and beyond are trying to hear from Tony directly and to, you know, get him on the record about what has happened. And, you know, I think one thing that's very key here that Adrian's attorney told me yesterday, and his name is Bobby Barreta, is that he does not believe that that Regina's suicide is directly connected to the affair. So, of course, as you saw in the story, as you read and as we're talking about, Bobby Barreta did confirm, yes, an affair was happening. It was an open secret. Everybody has known about it, you know, since it happened. And it was something that everybody in Uvalde and beyond knew about. But as far as if there is a connection to that affair and her death, her suicide, you know, and that is what it was ruled by the medical examiners, a suicide. You know, Adrian's own attorney, Bobby, said he doesn't think it's connected. So, you know, we don't know what was in her head at that moment. We don't know. And in our coverage, we have not said that it was directly that was the reason. We don't know what was going through her mind in that time that she did that, you know, that she took her own life in that just horrific way.
Bayless, what was Regina's status as an employee with Gonzalez at the time of her death, and what was her relationship? Was her status of her relationship with her husband?
Yeah, I think that's an important question because, as Nancy is explaining, we are not in any way tying a line to the suicide, but more giving this information to voters about, you know, what happened in the office. And so, Regina was a regional district director.
That she was still job. She still had that job at the time of her death.
Yes, she did. Yes. But it's important to note this affair ended in May 2024, as far as our reporting could tell us. And she died in September 2025. So there was a long gap. But this former staffer did say that after Regina's husband discovered the affair and texted other legislative staffers to say, I found out about this, Representative Gonzalez effectively stopped visiting the Uvalde office. And even on several occasions, the staffers, so Regina and the person I spoke with, would make memos and set up meetings with local officials and the congressman, and then he would cancel them, or his district director would cancel them.
All right.
Exactly.
Anything to add really quickly, Nancy?
I think one other thing is that, you know, when this happened, you know, the day after it happened and I spoke with Regina's mom, she did say that Regina had been trying to get back with her husband and, you know, to kind of reconcile their relationship. And so that might have been something, you know, that was really on her mind and, you know, getting into that state.
Very troubling story. Thank you both for your reporting, getting beyond the rumors and getting to the facts. We appreciate that. Bayless Wagner and Nancy Prayer Johnson from the San Antonio Express News. We got to take a break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be back to talk about DEI. Stay with us.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Under the Trump administration, DEI has become a public enemy. DEI is diversity, equity, and inclusion. It is an idea that everyone should have an opportunity to reach their full potential, and when they do, we're all better off. But President Trump has a view of DEI that it is a moral wrong and that it discriminates mainly against white Americans. We might think of DEI as a new idea, but as something that came about after the Civil Rights Movement. But in fact, it is more than 200 years old. There's a long history of DEI and ample evidence that DEI really helps society. It has certainly helped America succeed in a number of ways, and the abandonment of DEI will have deep cost to the nation. David Oppenheimer is the author of The Diversity Principle, the History of a Transformative Idea, the Story of a Transformative Idea. David Oppenheimer, welcome to The Source.
Thank you very much. A pleasure to be with you.
So, kind of sum up for me, what is the diversity principle?
The diversity principle is the idea that when we bring together people with different backgrounds and experiences, including people of different ages and religions and races and ethnicities and genders, that they make better decisions. When they engage with each other, they learn from each other, they learn more. In a science lab, they make more significant discoveries. In business, they make more money. In government, they come up with better policies. It's an idea that developed in the 19th century as a foundation to the modern university, and it has been with us ever since. And in the last 30 years, we have lots and lots of empirical evidence from a whole field called diversity science, that diversity really does make a difference in terms of improving our decision making, making our economy stronger, making us a better democracy.
When we talk about DEI, we sometimes hear DEIA, then the A would stand for accessibility. We're going to be talking about DEI, but I don't want to forget about accessibility.
Good. You're absolutely right. And the contributions that people make, people with disabilities, for example, people who've been excluded because of bias or prejudice, people who are outsiders. This goes all the way back. John Stuart Mill and Harriet Taylor Mill wrote extensively about the importance of including outsiders in society. And accessibility is the means of giving voice to outsiders. Whether we're talking about access in terms of disability or access in terms of all of the other criteria by which we exclude people and prevent them from having access.
So link DEI as an idea, as a public policy, to having an issue of freedom and liberty in a society.
Yeah, well, this takes us back to one of the great philosophers of the 18th and 19th century, Wilhelm von Humboldt, who founded the University of Berlin and who had an enormous influence on John Stuart Mill and Harriet Taylor Mill, whose most important work on liberty is the, it's the source, I'm looking at your logo, but it's the source of traditional liberalism. It's the source of the idea that liberty and diversity are closely linked, because we can't make the best decisions. We can't have our own individual freedom, what Humboldt called Bildung, unless, and my German is terrible, I know I mispronounced that, and I apologize to your German-speaking listeners. But the we can't do that unless we are exposed to lots of different voices, to people with different viewpoints, to people who've come out of different backgrounds. We need people who are rural. We need people who are urban. We need liberals. We need conservatives. We need people who speak different languages and come out of different cultures, all of them working together. Just, they make better decisions. They help move us forward. And I think it's the great strength of the United States. It's why we are the wealthiest economy in the history of the world. It's why our democracy has been the envy of people around the world. It's why our universities are the greatest universities in the world. It's because of the diversity of this country, because we are so much a nation of immigrants.
I'm very much interested in how DEI, how it has, how important it is in the administration of justice at the courthouse. Without DEI, with excluding people, you can't really have true justice, I don't think.
Yeah, well, you know, it's very interesting. If you look at studies of how a all-white jury judges a case, and then you look at studies of racially integrated and or gender integrated juries and how they look at a case, there are very important differences in terms of the facts that they remember and the process by which they make decisions. And it's not simply a case of prejudice and bias, but being in a diverse group makes us more aware. And the result is, in terms of the justice system, when you have diversity on juries, juries make more accurate decisions. We know this experientially, and we know it experimentally.
So you've been studying DEI, I imagine, for quite a while, before it became a controversial idea in politics. What did you think about when suddenly DEI became a public enemy by the most powerful people in America?
Shock, dismay. I started working on this book, The Diversity Principle, about 14 years ago, when a colleague mentioned that she thought there was probably a link between the idea of diversity in college admissions and the business case for diversity, but she hadn't seen the source of that link. And I thought that was very interesting. And so I started looking into that, and I had the good fortune to run into works by two great conservative icons who helped me find my way. One was the federal judge and University of Chicago professor. Oh, I can't believe I'm about to do this. I am.
That's all right. Blanking out. I do it all the time.
I'm losing his name. And he served for many years as a federal judge and as a law professor at Chicago, and put out a book a year. One of the most extraordinary jurists in American history. And he wrote about diversity back in the 1960s. And my name will come to him, his name will come to me soon. And then Hayek, the great conservative economist, who was the first biographer of Harriet Taylor Mill. And they and others helped me to find my way all the way back in terms of looking at the history of this idea of diversity to the founding of the first modern research university, to the advocacy and work of John Stuart Mill and Harriet Taylor Mill, and then to the way in which these ideas about diversity made their way in American law, with which I was more familiar, through a really interesting relationship between Felix Frankfurter, a then young law professor, and Oliver Wendell Holmes, a then elderly Supreme Court justice, and how they, through their relationship, got Holmes to rethink what we now call the marketplace of ideas, and to argue and ultimately persuade the Supreme Court that our First Amendment guaranteed us a right to express unpopular ideas. That was at the heart of the Mills on Liberty. It's at the heart of our First Amendment jurisprudence now. There are over 100 Supreme Court decisions that talk about the marketplace of ideas, a phrase attributed to the Mills, although actually I don't think they ever used it. But they talked about a marketplace, and they talked about the idea of having diverse ideas and the importance of diverse ideas coming from diverse communities. And when that made its way into our First Amendment and ultimately through Frankfurter into our law about academic freedom, it made diversity a foundation, first for American constitutional law and for American universities. And again, that's what has made our universities the envy of the world.
The Trump administration, they say that DEI weakens America, that it undermines our meritocracy. So is that true?
It's silly. I shouldn't call it silly because of the impact that it's having. But it's a foolish idea that it weakens us. Quite the opposite is true. Homogeneous groups don't make decisions that are as effective as diverse groups. Meritocracy, I believe in meritocracy, but I think they are defining merit in a ridiculously narrow way. And they are bringing such bias to the process that they don't see the work of people who are not white and male as being meritorious. Gosh, do you know the story about the Trump administration firing the Librarian of Congress?
Mm-hmm.
Here's a woman who'd spent her entire life training as a librarian and doing major work running the public library systems in Chicago and in Baltimore, and had a PhD in library science, had grown up poor and loving books and then loving reading at the library to children with autism is how she got her start. She gets fired from her position as Librarian of Congress, first black person to hold the job, first woman to hold the job, so obviously first black woman to hold the job, 6 years into a 10-year term. And the explanation that's given is that she wanted to lend or was lending LGBT-themed books to children at the Library of Congress. The Library of Congress is not a lending library. The Library of Congress is a research library. Primarily,
they have no children's section.
There's no children's section. There's no reading section. You go there. You have to be an adult to go there. You have to be 16 or over. And you go there because you're doing a research project, usually for a member of Congress, although the rest of us are also welcome to go there and get their assistance on research projects. But it's just, you know, what a terrible thing to fire this highly competent woman, who was replaced, by the way, at least on a temporary basis, by one of President Trump's lawyers, who is a white man who, as far as I can tell, has no background in library science. and then call that a meritocracy? It's not. It's blatantly disrespecting women. It's blatantly disrespecting Black and Hispanic Americans. And yes, they're also attacking LGBT people. They are disrespecting people with disabilities. They have this image of meritocracy that is so narrow.
Right. And they talk about having a colorblind system after DEI, and we're seeing that it's, and that may not hold up. We're going to take a break here. We're going to continue our discussion about the diversity principle, the story of a transformative idea, with the author David Oppenheimer. You can call in 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source will continue after this break. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In his first week in office, in his second term, President Trump issued a series of executive orders targeting diversity, equity, and inclusion programs across federal agencies, contractors, and by extension into the private sector, framing them as, quote, illegal discrimination. Executive orders terminated DEI offices, they mandated merit-based hiring, and removed DEI and DEIA and gender-inclusive language from federal, foreign service, and educational policies, with enforcement impacting grants and contracts. The debate over DEI has become one of the sharpest cultural and political conflicts in the U.S. It's touching universities, corporations, governments, the military, what's happening at the courthouse, and federal agencies. We're joined by David Oppenheimer. He has written a history of DEI and an examination of how it works. The book is The Diversity Principle, The Story of a Transformative Idea. You can call in with your questions and comments about DEI. Do you resent it? Do you think that you were harmed by it in any way? Or do you see this as really a great benefit to the country in order to try to help as many people as we can reach their full potential? 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can also email us at thesource@tpr.org. In your book, you write about Pauli Murray as a central figure. Why is her role been underrecognized in the mainstream civil rights narrative? What role did she have in bringing DEI to the forefront?
Pauli Murray, thank you for asking about that. Pauli Murray was a remarkable person, a queer Black woman who today would probably identify as a transgender male. She, in the 1940s, studied Gandhian civil disobedience, nonviolence, and indirectly helped Dr. King to learn about it. She then, as a law student at Howard, she was the only woman in her class. The men wouldn't talk to her, but she finished first in her class. She wrote a terrific memo for Thurgood Marshall on the diversity principle and the reason that desegregation should be argued in terms of the importance for Black children of being able to participate in a desegregated and integrated society, in terms of the benefits of diversity, that persuaded him to make changes in the way he was arguing the cases that led to Brown v. Board of Education. She then, when the 1964 Civil Rights Act that prohibits sex discrimination was about to pass with an amendment that would have taken sex discrimination out, got to Lady Bird Johnson and persuaded her to convince Lyndon Johnson, to convince his allies in the Senate, to keep sex discrimination in the law. She went to work for the ACLU and convinced the board that they should hire this very shy law professor from Rutgers for a women's rights project. That was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She and Ginsburg together developed the arguments that led to the Supreme Court ruling that sex discrimination is a violation of the Constitution. At every step of our civil rights legal victories from the 1940s through the 1990s, she was there as a partner, but in the background. And then she left the law, became an Episcopal priest, and has been sainted, deified by the Episcopal Church. She's just a remarkable, remarkable person who deeply understood the value of diversity through her own experiences with exclusion. She'd been rejected by the University of North Carolina because she was Black. She couldn't get into Harvard Law School because she was a woman. It's a remarkable story, and people should know more about her.
If Murray were alive today, what do you think she'd be saying about this framing that we have now from the Trump administration that we want to have a colorblind society?
I think she would say that colorblindness is actually just blindness to racism. That in a society in which people engage in racial bias and prejudice at an unconscious level, that to simply say we shouldn't consider race means that race becomes part of the background of the way we make decisions, and to the great detriment of Black Americans and other people of color. And so I think she would have said that this idea of colorblindness is it's
race discrimination by another name.
That's correct. Thank you.
So what kind of evidence, empirical certainty, what do we have here that tells us, that can tell us that, you know, having diversity, DEI, has made America great?
Well, of course, there's no certainty in science, but the empirical evidence about the diversity principle, the empirical evidence that diversity improves decision-making, that diversity leads to greater profits for businesses, that diversity gives us better, more significant inventions in science labs, is very, very strong. There are outlier studies, as is always the case, but the studies overwhelmingly show that the benefits of diversity are measurable, are real, and are an important part of the greatness of our country.
So give me an example. What happened? I mean, we can talk about the Navajo cold talkers if we want, or, you know, that diversity, or the people who have invented great things, who've led incredible movements, who've really lifted America up, and they didn't fit that straight white Christian male category.
Sure. Well, I mean, at the individual level, there are lots and lots and lots of examples of great scientists, of great philosophers, of great business leaders who are not white. I read that 71% of the Nobel Prizes that have been awarded since the prize was first created have gone to Americans, have gone to people from the United States, which itself is extraordinary. And then over the last 30 years, if you look at the awards that have gone to Americans in the hard sciences, in biology, chemistry, physics, the 41% of them have gone to people who were first generation, who were immigrants to the United States. This is an example of how we benefit from people joining our country and joining our society with lots of different backgrounds and experiences. And I'll give you another example. Clarence Thomas is regarded, I think properly, as a very conservative member of the Supreme Court. And he is somebody who rejects the diversity principle. But if you look at his opinion in Black v. Virginia, a case in which the eight white members of the court all agreed that when the Ku Klux Klan burns a cross, it's a form of political speech, and the First Amendment applies. It doesn't necessarily mean it's permissible, but they agreed that it's political speech. And only Justice Thomas said, no, you don't understand. This is not political speech. This is intimidation. This is outside the kinds of speech that we protect under the First Amendment. It's not about politics. It's about terrorism. He had that understanding because of his background and experience as a black man in America.
Growing up really poor, in poverty.
Yes, he did.
Do you think that Clarence Thomas would have made it to the Supreme Court without DEI?
It's clear to me that President Bush was looking for a black jurist to replace Thurgood Marshall when Marshall stepped down. But there's this common view, I think, by people on the left and people on the right, that dismisses Justice Thomas as sort of a second-rate intellect. And I don't agree with that. I find some of his ideas, particularly about the meaning of the First Amendment and religious freedom, I don't like them at all. He and I disagree.
Yeah, but he was given opportunities because he is an African American male.
Well, sure.
Okay, sure. That's DEI.
That's true. That's right. That's affirmative action policies that have now been made illegal in part by Justice Thomas's opinions. I don't know that you can say as to any individual person, but for affirmative action, he would not have achieved that. And I have a bone to pick with those who use Justice Thomas's race as a way of saying, suggesting that he doesn't deserve to be where he is.
Deserve to be there. You do the hard work to get there.
Right.
Having that door open for you, that's the other issue. I think that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about giving free rides. We're talking about giving people the opportunity to work hard and succeed. We got to take a break here. I got Loretta on the board. We're going to get you on the air. 833-877-8255. The Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about the book, The Diversity Principle, The Story of a Transformative Idea. We're with the author, David Oppenheimer. Loretta has called in. Loretta, thanks for calling in. Sometimes I feel like I'm just sitting here talking to myself until the callers start calling in. So you're on the air, Loretta. Go ahead.
What I wanted to say is I so appreciate your show and the themes of social justice in DEI that you bring up regularly. And I recently left my teaching job, partly because I was worried about getting our school sued with the new laws. But what I want to say, because I've had to think about this a lot, is, and other people have had these solutions, and so did your other caller, your other speaker a couple of days ago, that without DEI, that robs, and the history of injustice, that robs people of the fire that history gives them for making a world a better place. So I was thinking that you and Mr. Oppenheimer could help us organize a speakers bureau, because the university has... Part of the problem with climate change is that the information was siloed in the university at times and it didn't get out via storytelling. So we have an opportunity to bring the history of injustice in our country out into cafes and libraries, which everybody is doing. We need to do this across the country. So if you could help us organize that, that would be fantastic.
All right, Loretta. I kind of have my hands full with this job, but we'll see what we can do. So David Oppenheimer, how should people be talking about this?
Well, people should be talking. People should be talking with people they disagree with. People should be talking in and meeting in groups as diverse as possible. People should be sharing their experiences and looking for opportunities to share experiences and to work collaboratively with people who have different backgrounds, who have different viewpoints. You know, to Loretta's point, one of the great things that bookstores do is bring lots of people together with different backgrounds and experiences for book talks. And it's one of the ways that people get out there and speak about ideas that they've been developing. And can I put in a plug for the doc?
Yeah.
The bookstore in Fort Worth, which has 3 or 4 book talks a week and is just a terrific source of books and thinking about the Black experience in Texas and beyond. And I'm going to be there on March 9th. I'm looking forward to meeting the folks there.
Awesome. Let's go to the next caller. We have Alex. Alex, you're on the air.
Yeah, so my comment slash question is more about DEI and in the U.S. government. There's a YouTuber, and the video was floating around. A YouTuber was asking Charlie Kirk, the late Charlie Kirk, a question about diversity, equity, inclusion as it involves the U.S. government, the U.S. Senate specifically, in that the U.S. Senate is a good representation of diversity, equity, inclusion. We have these smaller states, and I'm from California, but I live in Texas now, both ginormous states. Yet in the Senate, they only have 2 votes, just like every other state. States like Rhode Island, they are given more power simply because they are a different, say, a minority in this case. How is that any different? I don't think the Republicans or the conservatives would be okay with thinking that, okay, well, yeah, we should get rid of the Senate because it does exactly what diversity and inclusion does. But how does that square with conservatives?
Okay, well, about the way the country came together and through the, you know, original founding and the Constitution that was passed, that was pretty much rock solid that smaller states would be protected by having the same political representation as the larger states in the Senate. And this is something that really cannot be changed under our current Constitution. But David Oppenheimer, did you want to jump on that?
Well, there's a wonderful book out recently about amending the Constitution by a Harvard professor and New Yorker staff writer Jill Lepore.
Sure.
And this question of 2 senators, which was put in part to save the institution of slavery by giving more power to the South than they otherwise would have had, and then admitting states only if you admitted a free state and a slave state at the same time, it is deeply undemocratic, Alex. I agree. It's deeply problematic. And if Charlie Kirk was saying the same thing, I'm glad to hear about something that the late Mr. Kirk and I agreed about. But
it's in the Constitution that this cannot be amended, that this is part of the Constitution. The only way to work around it is to break up big states.
David, I wasn't aware of that. I have to go back and look at that. Thank you.
Let's go to Stephen on the phones. And Stephen, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Good to be here. I wanted to talk about an experience I had when I was actually put onto the DEI Council. I used to work for a nonprofit based out of Downers Grove in Illinois. And they're one of the main certifying bodies in the information technology area. And like I said, they're a nonprofit. After the George Floyd murder and the riots and stuff, they created the DEI Council. And when they put it together, and the council itself was diverse, except for it did not have any white men on it. I'm Hispanic, so I'm sort of white. But the let me rephrase that. They didn't have any white straight men. There was one white guy, but he was not straight. And it turns out that in practice, this was more of a punish white Christian men group. This is the kind of thing that had so many people reacting against it, even though it does not represent the majority of the DEI programs, there were enough DEI programs out there that it put a bad taste for DEI in the mouths of some people, and that made it possible to blow this whole thing up into the ridiculousness that's happening now. Clearly, diversity is a good thing. Yes, equity is a good thing. Yes, inclusion is very, very helpful, both socially and economically. But the problem was when there were certain groups and certain companies that were taking the DEI concept and, in essence, that as an excuse for a rebranded affirmative action program.
All right, Stephen, thank you for the incredible information and dimension there. David Oppenheimer?
Well, sure. There are examples of diversity, our diversity, equity, and inclusion programs being very badly run. There are examples of them being unfairly run. I think of it not unlike a policy like driver's education, which is a very important thing in terms of helping young people to be better drivers and saving lives as a result. But there are some terrible driver's ed programs out there. There are some terrible DEI programs out there. And you can't judge an entire movement by a few examples. But having said that, my focus on this work is on the question of the benefits of diversity. And there are all kinds of ways to develop policies around diversity, both in terms of non-discrimination policies or anti-discrimination policies, and in terms of pro-diversity policies, including DEI or DEIA policies. We all have to do a better job at creating public policies that address public problems. One of the tools we have is our knowledge that diversity will help us do a better job at doing that.
It does seem like the public policy is that we cannot tolerate a white male from being held back just a little bit in favor of elevating entire demographics. You know, that we just can't tolerate, you know, any white person somehow being held back a little bit. And it's not a good trade-off.
For reasons that should be clear, discrimination against white men, which of course exists and of course is illegal, is more visible. Because white men are more visible.
Because they're the privileged class.
That's correct. And but if you look at the data, for example, if you look at census data for full-time employees age 25 to 34 who are college graduates, so young college graduates who have full-time jobs, white men earn over $70,000 a year at the median, while black women earn just over $50,000 a year at the median. That's an enormous difference. And Hispanic women, it's similar. Black and Hispanic men earn less than white men, and less. It's clear that we continue to live in a society in which there is enormous discrimination against women and against people of color, and that doesn't excuse any incident of discrimination against a white man, but it does put into perspective what's the social problem that we need to address.
The Diversity Principle, the story of a transformative idea. David B. Oppenheimer is the author. He is a political science professor at the Berkeley Law School. And thank you so much, David, for talking to us today.
Thank you very much, David, for having me.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.